Chapter 37 Sophistry. As I mentioned in the last chapter, there are unwritten rules of the Senate that everyone follows in order to maintain civility and foster productive working relationships. One of those unwritten rules is that you aren't supposed to repeat in public a conversation you've had with a colleague in private if that conversation makes your colleague look bad in any way. I've decided to observe that practice in this book with one exception, Ted Cruz. For what it's worth, I feel fully justified in doing so because Ted violated basic Senate protocol himself when he went to the floor and called Mitch McConnell a liar. It was the sort of thing that just isn't done, a breach of decorum so shocking that even I haven't committed it, and I love calling people liars. Anyway, here's the thing you have to understand about Ted Cruz. I like Ted Cruz more than most of my other colleagues like Ted Cruz, and I hate Ted Cruz. The reason I like Ted more than most of my other colleagues do is that he actually has a decent sense of humor. Ted has tried out jokes on me. They're usually pretty pedestrian, usually I can see the punchline coming, and many are not very good versions of constructions I've heard before. But as politician jokes go, they're not bad at all. And Ted is a fan of comedy, I think. You're never entirely sure with this guy. One Monday, after a week's recess, Ted came up to me on the floor to tell me that he and some friends had watched a rerun of my Stuart Smalley sketch with Michael Jordan and raved about how funny it was. I think he was being sincere, which meant it was a genuinely nice gesture. The only problem was that at that moment, I was talking to my friend Jeff Sessions about our respective recesses, and now I had to try to explain to Jeff what Ted was talking about, which meant I had to explain what recovery is, what affirmations are, what public access TV is, what a parody of public access TV is, and I had to do it all in about 30 seconds before Jeff lost interest, which of course I failed to do, and Jeff just kind of faded away to talk with someone else. Great. Anyway, Ted has a sense of humor, even if it's a lame one. And he did pay me a modest compliment, even if it was some Machiavellian ploy in service of his ambition to take over the world. The problem with Ted isn't that he's humorless. It isn't even his truly reprehensible far-right politics. No, the problem with Ted, and the reason so many senators have a problem with Ted, is simply that he's an absolutely toxic coworker. He's the guy in your office who snitches to corporate about your March Madness pool and microwaves fish in the office kitchen. He is the Dwight Schrute of the Senate. In a way, he's a perfect example of what I said in the last chapter about how it's not your knowledge of policy or your political talents, but rather your people skills that determine whether you succeed as a senator. For sure, Ted is extremely smart. Only the most brilliant young lawyers get to clerk for Supreme Court justices, and Ted got to clerk for Chief Justice William Rehnquist. And he's a truly gifted speaker who can frame an argument brilliantly. From what I've heard, when Cruz later returned to the court to argue cases in his capacity as Solicitor General of Texas, clerks would all make a point to be present in the chamber so they could watch him do his thing. I don't begrudge Ted that. There are plenty of senators who are smarter than I am or have more natural political aptitude than I do. For example, my own senior senator, Amy Klobuchar, or my friend Sheldon Whitehouse, one of the smartest people I've ever met, or Lindsey Graham. But I like them all, because none of them are sociopaths. Let me explain by telling you what I consider to be the quintessential Ted Cruz story. After the unspeakable mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, Dianne Feinstein introduced a bill to reinstate the federal assault weapons ban, which was enacted in 1994 and expired in 2004. Now, there are plenty of things we could be doing to address gun violence that are overwhelmingly popular, and aren't getting done only because Republicans have decided to refuse to do anything on guns, such as closing the loophole that allows people to buy guns at gun shows or on some websites without a background check. But there's a little more room for disagreement when it comes to the assault weapons ban. I, for one, wanted to co-sponsor Diane's bill right away, but we have a very strong gun culture in Minnesota, and my advisors in the state urge caution. Why be in such a rush to back the bill? How am I going to feel when this happens again? I asked. But I understood why many of my constituents felt differently. I love football. There's no reason to love football as much as I love football, but people live for their pastimes. And one popular pastime, especially in Minnesota, is target shooting with AR-15s. Who am I to say that that's any more or less valid of a hobby than watching football players give each other concussions? Anyway, I wanted to treat the debate with the seriousness it deserved, so even though I decided to support the assault weapons ban, I made sure to listen to both sides. I even visited a gun manufacturer in St. Cloud where they made AR-15s. It's actually a great company. They have a terrific record of hiring veterans, but they are very much central casting pro-gun guys. The company doesn't make ammunition clips, just the AR-15s themselves, so I decided to start with something I thought we could maybe agree on. I asked why anyone would need a 30-round magazine to go hunting, and the manager shook his head and said, "If anyone needs 10 bullets to take down a deer..." It seemed like we were finding some common ground, so why, I asked, would anyone need an assault rifle to go hunting at all? And one of the guys brought up feral pigs. Apparently they run in packs, and they're vicious. We don't have a lot of feral pigs in Minnesota, but they're evidently a real problem in parts of the South. "Has anyone ever been killed by a feral pig?" I asked. There was an awkward pause. Then someone said, "I heard of a guy who got bit in the leg." That didn't really seem like a reason to tote around an AR-15 with a 30-round magazine, but I didn't want to push my luck, so I asked, "Well, are they good eating, the feral pigs?" And one of the guys said, "If they're young." Okay, that wasn't a story about Ted Cruz, but it was a story about how fraught the debate was over the assault weapons ban and how I tried hard to take that debate seriously. And also, you learned something I bet you didn't know, which is that if you're going to eat a feral pig, you should eat a young one. Now, here's where Ted comes into the story. Back in Washington, Ted was taking absolutely no pains to listen to the other side. Instead, he was vehemently and theatrically opposing the bill with a series of fiery sermons on the Senate floor. And then one day he came up to me during a vote and said the following: "Anyone who's for the assault weapons ban is engaged in sophistry." Sophistry is an SAT word, one that I had neither seen nor heard nor spoken since I was 16 years old. Our English teacher, Mr. Glenn, had assigned us a vocabulary book, and we were to learn 3 words a day. And one day, sophistry was one of the words. Sophistry is a form of argument that is intended to be deceitful. I don't think Ted knew that I was a co-sponsor of Diane's bill. I also don't think he knew that I knew what sophistry meant, which I think is why he used the word. But I played along. Why am I engaged in sophistry? Because, Ted said, Clinton's own Department of Justice did a study of the assault weapons ban and concluded that it doesn't work. "No, it didn't," I replied. "Actually, what the report said was that there wasn't enough data to reach a conclusion because the study was conducted only 2 years after the ban was implemented." "Just read the report," Ted sneered in his pugnacious way. I think pugnacious was also one of Mr. Glenn's vocabulary words. "I'll do that," I said with an edge of, truculence. After the vote, I took the Senate subway to my office and found Josh Riley, my judiciary counsel. "Ted Cruz just told me that anyone who's for the assault weapons ban is engaged in sophistry." Josh, I should mention, is like Ted, a super whip smart graduate of Harvard Law School. "What's sophistry?" he asked. I told Josh what sophistry is, and he nodded. What was his basis for that? He said it was because Clinton's Justice Department did a study that concluded that it hadn't worked. Josh frowned. That's not true. Then he proceeded to explain to me what I had already explained to Ted, that there wasn't enough data available at the time for Clinton's Justice Department to reach a firm conclusion. Still, I asked Josh to go find the Justice Department report and put a memo together so I could be prepared the next time I saw Ted. Josh went and found the Clinton Justice Department's impact evaluation, which was published in 1997, fulfilling the law's requirement that an analysis of the assault weapons ban be completed within 30 months of its enactment. And guess what? Josh and I were entirely right, and Ted was entirely wrong. The Clinton Justice Department wrote, "Our best estimate is that the ban contributed to a 6.7% decrease in total gun murders between 1994 and 1995, beyond what would have been expected in view of ongoing crime, demographic, and economic trends. However, with only 1 year of post-ban data, we cannot rule out the possibility that this decrease in gun murders reflects chance year-to-year variation rather than a true effect of the ban." In other words, the early results suggested that the ban might be working, but that there wasn't enough data to draw a definitive conclusion, exactly what I had told Ted. The next time I spotted Ted on the Senate floor, I approached him and said, "Well, I guess you owe me an apology." "Why?" "Well," I said, getting ready to hit him with some facts, "the last time we spoke, you said that anybody who's for the assault weapons ban is engaged in sophistry." To which Ted replied, "No, I didn't." As in a flat denial, not, "No, I didn't." Or, "Really? I said that?" Or, "That doesn't sound like something I'd say." It was just an unqualified, unequivocal, "No, I didn't." And that's when I realized that Ted Cruz was really something special. During the Judiciary Committee's first hearing on the assault weapons ban, Ted had engaged in his own odious brand of sophistry. First, he said this: "The assault weapons ban that used to be in effect, according to the Department of Justice, quote, failed to reduce the average number of victims per gun murder incident or multiple gunshot wounds victims." A 1999 summary of the 1997 report did say that. But that's very different from saying that the ban didn't work. In fact, the sentence immediately preceding the one Ted quoted said, "Evidence suggests that the ban may have contributed to a reduction in the gun murder rate and murders of police officers by criminals armed with assault weapons." Ted continued, "Now that is the assessment of the United States Department of Justice, and that is in 1994. Actually, the Clinton Justice Department's report came out in 1997, and the language Ted cited actually came from a 1999 summary of that report. That kind of a mistake is very common in the Senate and in life, an innocent mistake, I'm sure, which is rare for someone as meticulous and or malevolent as Ted. Ted went on, "That was the Janet Reno Department of Justice under President Clinton that said the assault weapons ban was singularly ineffective." No, the report said nothing of the kind. The Microsoft Word thesaurus, which is even easier for me to consult while writing than the one built into Google, lists the following words as synonyms for singularly: unusually, especially, exceptionally, rarely, and surprisingly. So Cruz was saying that the DOJ had called the assault weapons ban exceptionally ineffective. Of course, not only does the report say no such thing, but it repeatedly makes the exact opposite point, which was that there was not yet enough evidence to draw any conclusive determination. Ted was being singularly dishonest, and exceptionally smarmy. After our hearings on the assault weapons ban, we went into executive session to mark up the bill. When it came time for Ted to speak, he treated us all to a breathtakingly patronizing lecture directed at Senator Feinstein, who had been in the Senate for 20 years, compared to Ted's 2 months. After helpfully reminding Diane that the Constitution is our foundational document and that the First and Second Amendments of the Constitution are part of the Bill of Rights, Ted went in for the kill. And the question that I would pose to the senior senator from California is, would she deem it consistent with the Bill of Rights for Congress to engage in the same endeavor that we are contemplating doing with the Second Amendment in the context of the First or Fourth Amendment? Namely, would she consider it constitutional for Congress to specify that the First Amendment shall apply only to the following books and shall not apply to the books that Congress has deemed outside the protection of the Bill of Rights? You get what he was trying to say, right? The bill would have outlawed assault weapons while leaving other guns legal. And Ted was suggesting that this was equivalent to selectively banning books. If this sounds like a very private school debate club way to talk about gun safety, please rest assured that it was delivered in the most private school debate club tone possible, like an actor performing a monologue in which he plays an intolerably smug, self-righteous high school debater in a blue blazer with brass buttons, but way, way overdoing it. Ted's condescension hung in the air like the stench from a cat box in an apartment with 40 cats belonging to an elderly woman who had just been found dead. It was bad, is what I'm saying. Dick Durbin jumped in. Would the senator yield for a question? But Diane wanted to respond herself. Let me just make a couple of points in response. One, I am not a sixth grader. Barely containing her anger, she reminded Ted that not only had she been a member of the Judiciary Committee for 20 years, but before that, she had been the mayor of San Francisco, an office to which she ascended when her predecessor, George Moscone, was assassinated, along with Supervisor Harvey Milk. In fact, Diane had been the one who discovered Harvey Milk's body. "I've seen the bullets that implode," she growled at Ted. Diane finished by reassuring Ted that she was familiar with the Constitution and sarcastically thanking him for the lecture. There was a sort of stunned silence. Then Chairman Leahy noted that Dick Durbin had asked for the floor. "Mr. Chairman," said Dick, "I can't add anything to that." But Ted could. Instead of dissolving into a fine pink shame mist, he piped up to clap back at the distinguished public servant who had just taken him to the woodshed. "I would note," he oozed, "that the senior senator from California did not answer my question, which is, in her judgment, would it be consistent with the Constitution for Congress to specify which books are permitted and which books are not?" "Well," I chimed in, "I've got a book that I don't think the First Amendment would permit. It's called Ted Cruz is a Pedophile." "That would be liable, unless, of course, you are a pedophile, which we don't know." No, I didn't say that, but man, I wanted to, and I kind of wish I had. Around that time, Amy Klobuchar was preparing to speak at the Gridiron Club dinner, an annual black tie affair held by the oldest and most prestigious organization for journalists in Washington. Traditionally, the president gives humorous remarks, as do two members of Congress, one from each party. For the record, Amy doesn't let me write jokes for her. That way, if someone asks her if I wrote any of her jokes, she can honestly say no. Besides, Amy's really funny and can fend for herself. But sometimes she'll run jokes by me, and every once in a while I'll have a suggestion on how to punch up one or two. Now, this was in early March of 2013, just a couple weeks after a Carnival cruise ship had been towed in the harbor after almost a week stranded at sea because of an engine fire. The ship had been nicknamed the Poop Cruise because passengers said the hallways were flooded with human waste, which had inspired a joke that Amy ran by me. When most people think of a bad cruise, they think of Carnival, but we think of Ted. I thought that was pretty good, but suggested a rewrite, which I'll get to in a moment. The Thursday before the gridiron, as we were taking a series of votes on the floor, I noticed Amy going around to a few senators she had written jokes about. Ah, I thought, Amy's getting their blessing. Then I saw her walk up to Ted. I thought, this could be interesting. So I went right over and inserted myself into a conversation triangle. Ted, Amy smiled, I've written a joke about you for the gridiron, and I wanted to get your okay. Sure, Ted smiled back. What's the joke? Well, Amy smiled, here it is. When most people think of a difficult cruise, they think of Carnival. But we Democrats in the Senate think of Ted. I noticed, of course, that she had softened the joke a bit, changing a bad cruise to a difficult cruise, and changing we think of Ted to we Democrats in the Senate think of Ted. Ted smiled. Then he offered a suggestion. What if you changed a difficult cruise to a challenging cruise? Oh, my God, what a putz. Now the joke isn't funny. I could tell that Amy was thinking the same thing, and so could Ted. So before Amy could respond, he smiled even more broadly and said magnanimously, I'll tell you what, I believe in the First Amendment. You go ahead and tell your joke. Wow, that was patronizing. I decided to step in. Say, Ted, I smiled. I did a rewrite of Amy's joke, and I think it's a lot better. You want to hear it? Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Amy having two successive thoughts. One, oh no, Al's not going to do this. Two, but I definitely want to be here if he does. Ted was still smiling. Sure. Okay, here it is. When most people think of a cruise as full of shit, they think of Carnival. But we think of Ted. And there went Ted's smile. For once, he had no words. I nodded, turned around, and walked away. Keep in mind this all happened within 2 months of Ted's arrival in Washington. There are senators who take 6 months slowly getting to know people and getting to know the institution before they even make their first floor speech, let alone manage to convince every other senator to hate them. Ted wasted no time pissing everybody off, including his fellow Republicans. A couple weeks before the gun debate, the Armed Services Committee held a hearing on Chuck Hagel's nomination to be defense secretary. Now, it wasn't unusual for a Republican senator to give an Obama appointee a hard time, but Chuck Hagel was a former Republican senator from Nebraska. The Republican side of the dais was packed with senators who had known and worked with and respected Hagel for decades. But Ted decided to deliver another Cruzian performance piece, questioning the source of payments that Hagel had received for speaking engagements after leaving the Senate and making an inflammatory insinuation. It is, at a minimum, relevant to know if that $200,000 that he deposited in his bank account came directly from Saudi Arabia, came directly from North Korea. Yeah. Just like it would be relevant to know if you were a pedophile, Ted. But at least I had the good taste not to say that out loud, but instead to write it in a book 5 years later. Republicans were at least polite about brushing back the brash new senator, with Lindsey Graham saying Cruz's remarks were out of bounds. Democrats in the media were less restrained, comparing Ted's intimation to McCarthy-esque innuendo. It takes a special kind of jerk to get compared to Joe McCarthy just a month into your Senate career. Although it didn't help Ted that he bears more than a passing resemblance to McCarthy himself. Franny thinks he's the love child of McCarthy and Dracula. Of course, Ted has been leaving a bad taste in people's mouths his whole life. His college roommate, screenwriter Craig Mazin, had been warning people about Cruz since the moment he leapt onto the national stage in the 2012 election, and when Ted ran for president in 2016, Mazin was only too happy to share some memories of what young Ted Cruz had been like. As a freshman, he tweeted one day, I would get into senior parties because I was Ted's roommate, out of pity. He was that widely loathed. It's his superpower. Keep in mind, this is at Princeton. Ted Cruz was too much of a smug jerk to fit in at Princeton. And then he went to Harvard Law School, where, during his very first week, he created a study group. Hey, that's kind of human. Except that, in order to apply to be part of Ted's study group, you had to have gone to Harvard, Princeton, or Yale for college. GQ interviewed Ted's law school roommate, who explained, he said he didn't want anybody from minor Ivies, like Penn or Brown. Now, if I spent 1,000 years on a desert island, I couldn't come up with a more obnoxious way to show my new classmates that I was a world-class butthole. I could fill several chapters with Ted Cruz's awfulness, but I'll end with one of my favorite keepsakes from my time in the Senate. It was a picture taken during an especially long and tedious executive session of the Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, during which we discussed and voted on Tom Udall's proposed constitutional amendment to overturn the Citizens United decision. The amendment would have simply restored the power of Congress and the states to regulate and set reasonable limits on the raising and spending of money by candidates and others to influence elections. Such laws, of course, had existed for many years before the Supreme Court decided to wipe them all out with a 5-4 vote. Ted opposed this, of course, and spoke against it in pieces that added up to a good hour, making bogus point after bogus point, which was why the hearing was so long and tedious. This amendment here today, he said at one point, would repeal the free speech protections of the First Amendment. And this amendment, if adopted, would give Congress absolute authority to regulate the political speech of every single American with no limitations whatsoever. And later, any politician who put his or her name to an amendment taking away the free speech rights of every American, in my view, should be embarrassed. Stuff like that. He also tied together his blatant disregard for the truth, his relentless appetite for grandstanding, and his cringeworthy habit of making pop culture references in an argument that seemed designed just to irritate me, referring to the political satire on Saturday Night Live, specifically Tina Fey playing Sarah Palin. According to Ted, if Citizens United were to be reversed, Tina would not have been able to do her Sarah Palin on the show because NBC is a corporation. Of course, as I pointed out, Tina did Sarah Palin during the 2008 election, 2 years before the Citizens United decision. Danny Aykroyd did Carter before Citizens United. Phil Hartman did Reagan. Dana Carvey did George H.W. Bush. Hartman did Bill Clinton, as did Daryl Hammond. And Will Ferrell did George W. Bush, all before Citizens United. So even if you bought Ted's bogus argument that preventing corporations from pouring billions of dollars in dark money into shadowy super PACs was equivalent to outlawing any political speech on the public airwaves, this wasn't even a relevant example. It was just a dishonest and unpleasant man trying and failing to use pop culture to make a false argument. In fact, a few months later, he made the same argument in a floor speech where he added, Lorne Michaels could be put in jail under this amendment for making fun of any politician. Ted Cruz isn't just wrong about almost everything. He's impossible to work with. And he doesn't care that he's impossible to work with. And that's why, even when the choice was between Ted Cruz, who was a sitting member of the United States Senate, and Donald Trump, who was Donald Trump, establishment Republicans couldn't bring themselves to rally behind Cruz. Even if you like what he stands for, the most he'll ever be able to accomplish is being an obnoxious wrench in the gears of government, like when he led the government shutdown over the Affordable Care Act. Real senatoring requires that you build productive relationships with your colleagues. And Ted just isn't that kind of guy. Which brings me to that photograph from the hearing. Now, you're not going to see it, but in the picture, you see Dick Durbin just painfully staring out to middle distance, just in anguish out of boredom. Me, painfully bored. Josh staring in boredom. And Cruz talking. And has the inscription, "Sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words of sophistry."